Hello and welcome to the Feed the Ball podcast. It's been a while since we've done an episode of The Wrap, but it's that time of year, and we're going to dig deep into the site of this week's PGA Championship, Aronimink Golf Club outside of Philadelphia. Typically, I have two guests join me on The Wrap, but for this edition, I have just one, Ron Pritchard. I wanted Ron by himself to make sure he had the space to talk freely and associatively about a golf course he knows about as well as anyone. For those of you who need a refresher, Ron was the first architect to legitimize what we now call historical restoration in the 1980s. That's when he began to advise older clubs that their courses were out of step with the look and intent and character of their original designs. Restoration has since become a buzzword, and everyone and every club says they're doing it, but Ron was the forefather of that movement. Ron was also one of my very first guests on Feed the Ball back in 2017 in episode 5, and I encourage you to listen to that episode where you can get to know him much better. Ron began working with Aronimink in 1994 when he initiated a long-term restoration of the club's Donald Ross design and continued in that role until about 2015 when the club went a different direction and hired Gil Hanse and Jim Wagner to initiate their own restoration of the course. If you followed Aronimink at all, and especially in the last week or so, you'll be familiar with the story. In particular, how Donald Ross's vision for Aronimink, the course he created through blueprints and detailed field notes, is different than the course that opened in 1929, especially in the bunkering. His construction foreman and associate for Aronimink, J.B. McGovern, altered the bunkering scheme. He broke Ross's more typical large format bunkers into smaller clusters of twos and threes and fours, and it took the total number of bunkers from several dozen to over 200. Whether Ross ultimately approved of or even knew about this until later is not known. Pritchard, while he was consulting, was working with Aronimink to restore the course that Ross envisioned. Hanse and Wagner restored the course to the 1929 as-built version with McGovern's bunkering. Ron and I get into all of this in some detail, but the discrepancy between what Ross drew and what McGovern built has long bothered him. The Hanse and Wagner version of the restoration has also created a lot of need for explanation. I'm a fan of the Hanse and Wagner restoration. I think Aronimink functions well and is an engaging and quite interesting golf course to play and look at, especially for regular members. But in all of the talk about the course this week, I think it's important for Ron's voice and insights about Aronimink to be heard. There's a backstory to every golf course and a trail of events that bring us to a particular moment in time, and I think this episode of The Wrap will provide a more thorough understanding of Aronimink's evolution than most of the reporting that I've seen about the course so far. I hope you stick around all the way to the end when we discuss some of the strongest and weakest holes, and throughout the talk, Ron weaves in anecdotes and informative nuggets about Donald Ross, his other courses, and the way he worked. Ron is in his 80s. I think he said he's 85. And he's still working and still strong, and he's a fantastic guest and person to talk golf course architecture and history with. So here we are. Enjoy it. This is The Wrap, Aronimink style, with Ron Pritchard. Ron, it's great to be with you. This week, actually, is the PGA Championship at Aronimink, and you've had a long history with that club and did a lot of work there. You live in the Philadelphia area, so I can't think of anybody better to talk to about Aronimink than you. So thanks for joining us. Refresh our memories about your experience working on Donald Ross courses in particular. I always consider you... And I've said this, I believe I said this in the first podcast that we did, and I've said it elsewhere, that I consider you really the godfather of the current restoration movement. And we can get into the term restoration and what that means. I don't know, you know, that's a weighted subject, but the concept of visiting historic golf courses and attempting to draw out all of the lost features and the lost strategic aspects that had been buried over through years of maintenance and renovation and for other reasons, but really to try to define what the courses were like as intended when they were first built and to re-implement those concepts. You were really one of the first, if not the first person to do that. Certainly the first to kind of be the Pied Piper and carry that message around the country to clubs and to really stand for that concept of honoring history. So I mean, I think you deserve credit for pioneering that industry, but specifically about Ross, what drew you to Ross and how did you get into really kind of focusing on his golf courses?
Well, when I decided to sort of devote my career professionally to trying to convince clubs to restore their golf courses, the first one I did was a Langford Moreau golf course in Texarkana, Texas.
Right.
And I remodel it. You know, it had been done before in the mid 50s. And when I got there, actually, what led to it all was I worked for 14 years with three other architects, and I worked with Jack Nicklaus for just a little time when he and Desmond Muirhead were associated together when we did Muirfield and so forth, which I did not have a lot to do with Muirfield. But anyway, I was really bothered by the fact that the architects in the 50s and 60s, and I wasn't working in the 50s in the business, but I
you're
was
a
really
veteran, but you're not that veteran.
The changes that they were making on golf courses that I felt were, you know, really classics, important. My appreciation for traditional classical architecture really developed because I did spend a fair amount of time in Scotland and Ireland and England traveling around to the golf courses. And then I did the first golf course that I kind of was introduced to was the Knoll in Boonton, New Jersey.
Okay.
It's a Rainer course, mm-hmm. Boontoi. It's in northern New Jersey. I lived only about 7 or 8 miles away, and I caddied there. He said ride by bike over and caddy, and that was a pretty good golf course back when I was a young boy. So all this stuff began to seep into my system, and then, you know, I decided that I wanted to devote my career to trying to convince these clubs that own these old classic courses to consider scrubbing away the modernization that they had undergone. With Ross, it was just a matter of me really, I probably played more of his golf courses and visited more of his golf courses. I went to college in Vermont, Middlebury College, and I used to go, and I played on the golf team, probably number 8 or 7. So, but we used to go down to Massachusetts, Boston area, and play a lot of Ross courses. You know, I really developed a strong appreciation for him. And then, you know, as time went on, I really, you know, I still feel like he was the best.
Ron, what was the first, do you remember the first Ross course that you consulted with?
It may have been Riverton in southern New Jersey, but I feel like it was before that, and I can't remember exactly who it was. I mean, decided to devote my career to Ross, I spent a lot of time really studying his work and visiting golf courses, and then I just sort of began to, you know, actually other people sort of heard about me. I had a meeting one time at Pinehurst early in the 90s, and some of the people, the Donald Ross Society, a lot of the Donald Ross Society people were there. That had by then been a growing association.
Right.
A lot of those people began to contact me, you know. Mm-hmm. And so primarily Ross courses because of their affiliation, you know.
Sure.
So, and I really, you know, I latched on to him in particular.
So, and this is going to be...
But I've done Rainer, so...
Right. So this is going to come up in this conversation about research and archives and finding Ross's blueprints, his field notes. How challenging was that when you first started getting into this line of work to locate the material that you would use to put these old courses back together?
A lot of clubs had the original routing plan, at least. And a lot of clubs did have all his field sketches. So it wasn't really that difficult. Mm-hmm. And then obviously there's a archives at the Gibbons Memorial Library down in Pinehurst.
Right, the Tufts, yes.
And they have hundreds of sketches, you know. So it wasn't all that hard. And obviously the Dalen collection, the photography at the Hagg Museum in Wilmington. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had such great photography, which was really helpful. So it really wasn't. I don't think of it as being that hard ever. I mean, I found the drawings at Country Club of Buffalo and at River Oaks and two or three other golf courses. This one up in the attic when I got there, and I remember at Country Club of Buffalo, they were just rolled up in an old rusty locker in the maintenance building. So I dragged them
Always,
out,
always look in the
superintendent, and we
maintenance
opened
buildings. That's where some of the plans are always the treasures are located.
it. It was a lot of fun.
I think what's notable about this is that the evidence that he left of how he created these courses, what he drew, what he intended, his thoughts was always there. It was available, but until you and then later some of your colleagues in this business came along, nobody really cared to look at them or thought that they had any practical value. It really took an effort from you looking at these courses through a historical lens to say, hey, we've got this documentation that is vital, and this is the blueprint for how to build or rebuild this golf course. It just nobody had thought about it because in the intervening decades, the thought for every club almost in America was modernization. It wasn't historical preservation. It wasn't restoration. It was modernization. It was moving the club forward according to the themes and the desires of the membership and golfers of the day, which changed through time.
There was very little appreciation of the early architects when I first began to focus on this. And I mean, the Creek Club and all sorts of golf courses, were the, I mean, most of the fine old golf courses owned by the wealthy, were owned by wealthy memberships in New England and Long Island and so forth, were designed by six or seven architects. And so, it just had, once I began to really focus on it, it sort of unraveled pretty quickly. People began then Golf Club Atlas came on, the website, and there was a lot of conversation about classical architecture there. And then
That was one of the good things that has come out of that forum is there was a lot of historical revelation and discovery that was happening, kind of crowdsourcing it.
I mean, I rarely posted on it because most of what I heard were guys that were just throwing out ideas. I mean, really, were not that well educated. They began to become more avid traditionalists. I mean, I've always considered myself a purist because I want to protect Ross in, his original form. I want to add as much length as I can on his golf courses, but I understand exactly why he put his bunkers where he did. And it's simple. I mean, it's so simple. He put his bunkers wherever the land provided an opportunity because there was a roll in the topography. So, example, he'd stuff a bunker like a Chicago golf club, which he didn't do, but that's a good example of, C.B. McDonald did that and Rayner was out there. But that's a beautiful example of just bunkering a golf course randomly, like at St. Andrews. There's no mathematical formula to bunkering correctly, and people, they don't understand it. They've all got to put it on the hook side where it impacts the best players, and it doesn't make sense.
Fascinating topic, and maybe we'll get into this. Let's turn our attention now to Aronimink. You began working there in, was it 1994? Is the first time? Do I have that right? Okay. What did you find at Aronimink when you first encountered that course, when you developed that relationship with the club? What was the course like?
Well, I had been there in 1987, and Roger Rulewicz was rebuilding a golf course. He worked for Robert Trent
Right,
Jones.
he was Robert Trent Jones's primary associate, especially in the 80s.
Yes, and they significantly changed Aronimink, particularly where all the bunkers was. But he just stole big pieces of the greens fill pad in several places so he could build big exterior mounding around his bunkers. And that's not where Ross never put a lot of filler on the outside of his bunkers, because he used all the filler he used when he dug a hole to build the back shoulder.
Right.
You never see it on the left or right, you know. And I took a lot of slide photographs. I still have them. And it bothered me, you know, to see that. And then I went in and I met with the general manager, who he was, you know, a wonderful man from England, Great Britain. Can't remember his name, but he gave me the routing plan, the original routing plan of Ross, and a little film clip that they have that circulated around the golf world that showed Ross actually at the golf course in its early stages.
Yep.
Big steam shovel they were working
with.
Yeah,
you can look this on YouTube and see it.
Right. So much is on YouTube.
Yeah.
It's just great. But
yeah.
So anyway, you know, it bothered me when I was there in 1987 a lot, because by then, you know, I was 5 or 6 years into the journey of trying to convince clubs to restore their golf courses. Here, Ronnie was modernizing their golf course. So somehow they called me up in 1994. I was part of a panel discussion at Pinehurst with Mike Stranz and
Mike Stranz, wow.
I can't think of a couple of guys. But so they contacted me, and I drove out there. And shortly after that, we had a great meeting. Jay Sigel attended. I began to work on my approach to it. I wanted to restore it to the original drawings, not to any photography or anything else, because the drawings at a Rademacher are maybe the best set of drawings Ross ever did. Primarily his overall restoration plan, his master plan, routing plan, because the field sketches were pretty primitive. But the wonderful thing with Ross was he would walk the golf course, and I really don't subscribe to the fact that he mailed things in. I believe that he practically walked every golf course that he was involved with, and he must have had a piece of paper on a board and sketched every hole beautifully. Never reproduced a hole in his life, and every bunker was unique. So, you know, I can read his handwriting just as well as I can read mine. So
that's good, because sometimes when I look at his field sketches, I can't read what he says, what he's written.
Yeah, you could if you look at it for a while.
Sometimes I'm like, what is he written there? I cannot make that out. But I guess you get used to it.
You could figure it out. I mean, if you spent, you know, a week really studying, you know, you'd learn.
Yeah.
Because his handwriting was a little bit sloppy. But, you know, he was a genius with his drawings, I think. I mean, not a well, you know, he basically was educated until he was 14 years old. Then he went, you know, then he went on his journey as an apprentice to a club maker to St. Andrews.
And at Rademacher, you had his routing map, which you say is one of his most comprehensive, and it's really beautifully illustrated.
And I could send this all to you, by the way, if you want any of these things.
No, I have it right here. I'm looking at it. It's in one of this book that I have. It's lovely. Yeah, I mean,
it's beautiful. Yes.
So your Ronnie calls you, and your plan is to, like you say to the club, let's take this golf course back to not the RTJ version that you have now, but let's take it back. And I would like to use this moment to point out that Ronnie had gone through a multiple renovations prior to that. I think that the first major renovation that I could track down and was aware was in 1961 by Dick Wilson, right before, you know, the 1962 PGA Championship. So that was the first time that the course really went under the first modernization. And then there were a series of other renovations after that, leading up to the late 1980s Robert Trent Jones renovate, we'll just call them renovations for lack of a better word. And that's so the course had undergone several mutations before you had ever gotten there.
Yeah. I never gave it much thought that I know that was the case, but I never gave it much thought really. I just knew that, I could see all the changes Trent Jones was making, and so I, kind of covered up some of the things that were done by the by. I think Fazio might have worked there, George. I'm not sure, but I know you're right that Dick Wilson.
Well, let's not bury the lead. The thing with the Aronimink, and that is so interesting about it and has been talked about a lot this week, is we have this beautiful routing map and hole diagrams that Ross left us, and that these were clearly, he put a lot of work into this and a lot of thought into these holes. And what is on the paper and what he drew in his blueprints is not what was built. What was built when the course opened in 1929 was the bunkering was different. The routing was the same. We maybe can get into the green structures and the contours from what we know or can discern, but the bunkering was the large typical Ross bunkers were broken up into smaller clusters. So there were basically three times as many bunkers upon opening day than Ross drew. Tell us about what you think happened to create
Right.
that situation.
Okay, well, I was aware of that because all those photographs from the Dalen collection were hanging in the locker room. So I was aware that somehow they had done J.B. McGovern, who was a member, one of Ross's associates, was a member, he was a green chairman also at Aronimink, at the new Aronimink built in the late 1920s. So I knew there had been this change, but when I made my presentation to the restoration committee, Jay Sigel was there. They particularly, the meeting was specifically to bring Jay Sigel up to date, on what was happening. He's a member at Aronimink and their best player, obviously. He came up to me afterwards and he said, "Ron, I've listened to you for an hour and a half, and I learned more about golf architecture than I have in a lifetime," which was. Touched my heart. I mean, I'll never forget that. But I was trying to convince them to let me restore it back to the drawings because I never had been built according to the drawings. Sure. The interesting thing is, last night I pulled out a program for the Pennsylvania State Amateur Golf Course of 1931. And inside that program, it's like about the size of a half the size of a newspaper. Inside that program in the 1931 amateur, they have sketches of all of Ross's original golf holes in that 1931 program, which amazes me because how did that happen if JB had already changed the golf course? But I called the Hagley Museum and JB and that the Dalen photograph apparently arrived 1929. So, I mean, I can't quite figure out that time situation anyway. Anyway, let me, so I don't think anybody knew before I began to recognize that J.B. McGovern had this inclination to finish to change Ross's bunkering on his golf courses because he did it at Irondequoit. In Rochester, another and it's another course, Brook something that I provided drawings of in Rochester, and I'd seen probably half a dozen plus Jeffersonville, the public golf course. J.B. McGovern was very much the builder of that golf course, and there were a lot of multiple clusters of bunkers there. I'll tell you something interesting if you have the time. When I was hired by Desmond Muirhead, I was as a young architect. This was 1974, 1973, 1974. When I joined Desmond, I knew that he and Jack Nicklaus had been retained to duplicate the old course in Scotland in Japan. So they were going to build a duplication of it, and I was in charge of that whole project. So that gave me a lot of time to. Get to Scotland and see all those great golf courses or anything. But the thing about the point of the story is that, I was kind of an arrogant young guy looking back, probably a little full of myself when I joined Desmond. And Pretty soon after I joined Desmond, he used to give me drawings that I would lay the Mylar on top of and trace his bunker shapes and things. I felt like a lot of his bunkers were unbuildable from a standpoint of the shape, because Desmond was very much influenced by modern art.
Right.
He knew nothing. I asked him, how much did Tillinghast, Ross, the guys influence you? You probably heard the story. But anyway, so he was a land sculptor, sort of, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, I started to change his drawings on his plans. And shortly after that, he noticed it. He came into my office. He's drawn a note work changing some of my bunker shapes. And he very nicely said to me, I would appreciate it if you don't do that. So really, it stung a little bit, but it was really a good lesson. And consequently, when I saw what J.B. McGovern does, it always has upset me. So I don't know if you can tie all that whole story together, but
Sure, because there's an architect who is hired by a client or a club, and he's the architect, and he employs people, and their job is to execute his plan. When they become the lead architect, they get to do what they want, but they're not there yet. Their job is to service the idea of the lead architect, right? So, but that brings us to this fundamental question about Iron Mink, this fundamental contradiction, which I think we can only surmise what happened. But you have Ross's plans. He clearly has an idea for how he wants these holes to look. You have a foreman or an associate, whatever J.B. McGovern was. He was a Philadelphian. He lives there. He was a member. He was on site every day. He essentially disregards Ross's plans and rebunkers the course. You have the plans, then you have the course that was actually constructed. Two different things. The first question
right.
is, how does that happen? And where is Ross, and what is Ross's viewpoint or reaction to this? Tangential to that, is Ross even aware that this is happening, or does he not come back to Aroniminc until the construction's done, it's grassed, it's open? Do we know anything about how you get from point A to point B? Because there's the crux of the whole issue.
I know Ross was there early in the construction, based on that film clip, because they
Right.
were just starting construction. I honestly don't think he paid a lot of attention to the golf course because he had a man there, you know. I don't know, you know, and he's a lot kinder hearted than I would have been if I came back to my golf course and saw that Ron Pritchard was doing what he did on Desmond Muirhead's golf
That's
course, you
right.
know.
Yeah.
So, but he did. But there is that famous quote on the first tee where Ross basically says, "You know, he basically says, I returned to Aroniminc and I built better than I thought I could,"
Let me
something to that effect.
read that right now. I've got it right here. Ross is quoted as
Yeah.
saying, and this is on a plaque on Aroniminc's first tee, and it's been elsewhere. He said, "I intended to make this course my masterpiece. But not until today did I realize I built better than I knew." So this is another contradiction or mystery embedded in this. When did he say this? Now, I assumed that he said this, I don't know, upon opening day or shortly after the course opened. I contacted the club, and I've never been able to find the original source
Yes.
material. I contacted Aroniminc, and their understanding was that this was made in the 1940s, toward the end of Ross's life, when at some point I'm assuming he came back to Aroniminc and saw the course then. So there's a that would
Yeah.
if we knew exactly when he said this, and maybe some listener has the original source material for this. I don't know if he said this to a newspaper. It's in his book.
Right.
But that was published later, and that's kind of a collection of different things, and I don't know where that came from. But if anybody knows, please let us know. But that makes a big difference. If he said it in 1929, then it's his approval of J.B. McGovern's alteration, unless he's just being political. But if he said that and did approve it, I don't think he would say, I intended to make this course my masterpiece. Because that denotes that he would have done it like that. If there was some change that McGovern, if McGovern edited without his knowledge, I don't think Ross would admit that he wanted this course to be his masterpiece because it didn't turn out the way he planned it. So there's this contradiction.
Well, I know. It's almost like two separate thoughts. I intended for this to be my masterpiece, but, you know, but I mean,
intent did not match with the result. Maybe, I don't know. It's, you could read into that.
Right. But I also think, Ross was too much of a gentleman to make a big scene. I mean, what could he do then? What could he do then anyway? Record them all? I mean, I would have been jumping up and down, pulling my hair on the first tee. But, you know, but I mean, that's, I'm different about that stuff.
Right. But don't all designers always say that to their clients? Oh, we did such a great job here. You know, like I've outdone myself with this golf course, you know, whether you believe it or not, that's good client relationship.
Yeah. I mean, she could have come back and said, I intended for this to be my masterpiece, but that damn J.B. McGovern rebuilt all my.
This is nothing like I.
You look at the face. Look at my face. I've been in a few fights in my life because I have a temper.
Well, he was, in that case, he would be a gentleman. And it's possible if he did see it toward the end of his life that he said, all right, you know, it's not bad. It's not maybe what I would do, but, you know, I intended to make this my masterpiece, but it turns out I never envisioned this and it turned out better than I thought it could have. There's another way to read that.
Yeah. You can read it, but here's the one compromise is that when, you know, I said, you know, when I restored a Ross bunker, I could do it by digging the pit, you know, maybe only 8 inches deep. You step down 8 inches, but you build a big, bold back shoulder. His bunkers were like catcher's mitts, you know. They basically cause you in his day a loss of distance because you had to hit a less lofted club than you do today. Guys are hitting 9 iron, it's really a 7 iron, you know. But anyway, what happens is if you take that same amount of soil and build 3 bunkers, you've got to use some of the soil to separate the bunkers. So where Ross was calling for almost all the time that his bunkers be 4 feet 6 inches deep, that's 54 inches. My eye is only 64 inches above the ground, you know, so basically I had 10 inches of clearance over the top of the back shoulder when I'm standing on the sand. But when you use part of that dirt to separate it into 3 separate bunkers, you end up with what they have now, which are basically 30-inch to 36-inch deep bunkers, which are less meaningful from a, you know, from the standpoint of, you know, Ross tried to basically penalize you a half stroke if you hit it into one of his bunkers.
Yes.
Which means you could escape, but then you've got to hit a great third shot.
So in essence,
really some
by breaking those bunker clusters and using the amount of fill that you have, you're shallowing out the bunkers and making them more playable versus Ross's intent.
You don't make it more shallow. You just lower the
back. The back edge. So they're easy, but they're easy to play out of, right?
One other thing that I've thought about since this thing is in the news a little bit, I don't really think Gil and I don't think Aronimi really understood JB's impact on the golf course. I don't think they understood that JB had this proclivity or inclination to do this repeatedly. Even at Jeffersonville, which is only 15 miles from my house. Mm-hmm. I don't think the club knew, and I don't think Gil knew when he decided, well, I'm going to build it the way those photographs illustrate that it was built originally with all those with those 200 bunkers. But I really don't think they knew. I don't think anybody in the world of Donald Ross knew until I was studying Ross's work and stumbling into several golf courses where they had multiple bunkers. And then I found out that JB was the construction associate.
One thing that one result of that, Ron, is that when JB McGovern made these alterations, he did it in the field. I mean, he didn't. I don't think that there's no evidence that he created his own blueprints for depth of bunkers and
on
bunker
the drawings. The drawings I sent you, he actually took a pencil and he separated the bunkers with a little pencil work.
Yeah, but where I was going with that
whatever it was.
Is Ross's plans, and they're usually the greenside bunkers. But he's telling the construction crews exactly how deep to make them and the angle of the face. So there was you have that intent behind his bunkers to know exactly how high you'd have to hit a shot to advance it out of the bunker. Whereas JB, by altering them in the field, we don't know how deep his bunkers were. We don't know exactly the height of his face because the two-dimensional photographs don't give us that information. So if you're going to rebuild those bunker clusters,
you look at the golf course today, you'll see what basically was the same as what JB produced, you know.
Yeah. But it's
because the bunkers are shallower.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to the difficulty of reconstructing using just photography, especially aerial photography, because it's two-dimensional.
Yes.
You don't get a sense of depth. You don't know how high the faces are. You can get the shapes right, but it's hard to get that third dimension. Because and JB didn't leave blueprints for his alteration, so it's guesswork.
Yeah, and he was there all the time as a member, as a green chairman. So I'm sure that most of it was laid out in the field. I mean, he might have had his own little pad that he sketched them quickly. But the amazing thing is that the clusters of bunkers that he utilized are right in the same location as the original big bunker.
You're
like
right.
on the first
yes.
hole, there's a
yeah.
big old right side bunker, and right where that bunker was is where the three bunkers are. So I mean, even that's interesting.
Yeah, it's Ron. It's and we're. Did J.B. McGovern leave any essays or writing behind? Do we have any idea of like what his viewpoint on architecture was?
No, not that I know of. So.
Well, it seems like McGovern, the reason that he broke up the clusters, we don't know if he had a particular view on playability or strategy or the penal nature of bunkers. We don't know that. But he must have had an aesthetic viewpoint that he just thought that breaking these larger bunkers up into smaller clusters looked better or fit into the landscape better or something.
I agree. I mean, it's interesting to me. You know, a lot of the bunkering that I have done, like Mountain Ridge up in West Caldwell, they're playing the LPGA event there today, tomorrow, and Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And all my original bunkers there has always been under attack by the senior members because they don't like having to play out of a bunker that's 54 inches from my feet to the top of the back shoulder.
Yeah.
You know, they don't like that. And so I think Aronimink may have also, every club I've ever restored, there's always been a lot of, you know, been a lot of people that are upset about the fact that I've sort of am a purist and I wanted to do the way Ross's field instructions told me to do it.
And maybe that's
which is fun if we're
trying to read anything into it. Maybe McGovern thought those bunkers were too challenging for memberships, and he was a member at Aronimink, so maybe he didn't want to have to hit out of Ross's bunkers himself, so he broke them into shallower or clusters with lower faces. Maybe we can deduce that if we're reaching
right. And I've always had great fun arguing with these older people because, I mean, now I'm older than most
yeah.
of them were. But I've always had fun with them. Even though they are angry, you know, it's fun because, you know, you could pretty much say whatever you want if you have a smile on your face when you say it.
There you go.
Say, I'm smiling right now.
Well, if we can't smile, then what do we do? You got to laugh. So I'd like to go back to this, right. this topic one more time. So Ross lays out the plans. The course is built differently. It's how common was that for Ross to not really see the finished product? You know, and I think I've seen a chart that you did once where you map out through the decades of the 1920s how many projects Ross had going around the country each year. And it's like 15 to 20 or 25 courses at some stage of production right. at a time every year. So it's plausible, right?
Let me explain.
Right,
let me tell you an example of the worst case. 1921, he had 40 projects going.
40?
1920, he had 20 projects going. 40 in 1921 alone. Now, some of them were continuations of, you know, but there were 40 projects in construction at one time, based on all of my study of his work and his timetable, and 20 the year before and 20 the year afterward. That's 80 golf courses he was involved with, you know, in a 3-year period. That's a whole career for a lot of guys.
Unbelievable.
I mean, your point is right. I mean, don't forget, and they had, I mean, Ross has, he could either get in his car or get on a railroad train. No, there was no flying other than the mail planes back in those days.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's important for everybody to do, I used to get mad at Golf Club Atlas because people didn't demonstrate the capability of putting themselves in the shoes of the architect at the time he did the work.
you have to
think that way.
Absolutely. Yeah. Don't get me started on that.
I mean,
that.
I always look at the first green at the Pine Valley, and I think, my God, in 1914 they moved that amount of dirt to build the first green at Pine Valley. It's way up in the air.
It sits so high up in
the.
You go
to the back of the fill pad. I mean,
it seems like drops down 20 feet.
Yeah. But can you? I mean, so they're moving it with pans and scrapers behind horses.
Right.
No bulldozers, you know, not many trucks in those days.
I think the key year for Aronim Inc., and you can go back and look at aerials that verify this, it was the Dick Wilson's renovation in 1961 when those bunker clusters were combined into large bunkers. That's when all the clustering changed. And every year after that, Aronim Inc. has.
I never saw that.
Yeah, you can look at aerials and see that from 1961 through the time that you began working there, Aronim Inc. has what we would consider typical large bunkers, much fewer than there are today.
Yeah.
More closely, they moved around. I don't know what their shapes looked like. I don't know how high the back shoulders were, but the shapes of the bunkers are large format. So that's the golf course that you inherited. Now, Robert Trent Jones had made a lot of alterations, changed the shaping of the golf course, etc. But when you started working at Aronim Inc., there were no small bunker clusters. The bunkers were large, typical, traditional.
No, I just assumed they were all Trent Jones. You can see on the restoration plan that I sent you, the colored plan, if you blow it up, you can see where Trent Jones's bunkers were little in dashed lines. Those are the ones that I filled in and then built what I felt was
right.
Ross's.
I guess where I'm going
bunker.
With that is that I don't know how many bunkers were on the golf course when you started working at Aronim Inc. 70, some 60, 70, something like that. Maybe more.
Probably, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the bunkers had already been reduced drastically and combined. So when you approached the club with the idea of restoring the Ross master plan, it was completely logical based on the bunkering that they had at that time. You were not suggesting that they go from 200 bunkers down to 70. They had 70. You said, let's relocate them to where Ross had them. Let's build them in structurally the way Ross drew them on his blueprints. Dick Wilson was the one who went to the club and said, let's take these 210 bunkers and shrink them down to 70. So that process of taking J.B. McGovern out of the course had been done a long, long time ago. So I just think that's important to note that you were not proposing anything radical to the club other than let's honor Donald Ross, what he drew on his paper. And you could even take it a step further and say, J.B. McGovern built something that Donald Ross didn't intend. We have a chance to now build a golf course that Donald Ross intended because J.B. McGovern has already been erased. What the club did with Gil Hance...
That's interesting.
What the club did with Gil Hance is Gil looked at the aerials and said, let's build it as it was actually... Let's rebuild it as it actually was built in 1929. And I'm not going to make a judgment call on that. I find the golf course as it is today, Aronimink, as built to the J.B. McGovern completion date, the as-built version, I find it very compelling. But I do think it's important to note that your advocacy of the Ross plan was completely consistent with the golf course as you found it. It was not purposefully intended to erase J.B. McGovern. You saw the opportunity to coax out the Ross that had been erased in 1961.
Yep. I mean, I hadn't thought of that because I just made that big leap of time from, these drawings in 1926 to 1994. You know, what I say, 26, to 1994, and I felt, because the golf course was drawn in 1926 by Ross. And I knew that other people had done things, including Trent Jones, but I didn't know that Dick Wilson, that he eliminated the multiple bunkers that JB designed.
Yes.
I mean, it's interesting to me.
Now, the real... hypothetical, Ron, is had 1994, if Aronimink still had 210 bunkers like Jamie McGovern had built, would you have still advocated the club combine those into the what Ross drew on his plans and essentially say, we want to go back to the quote unquote theoretical course that Ross drew and remove the empirical course that was built in 1929?
I probably would have been brazen.
Good for you.
But the other thing was that in addition to the bunker work, I had to really rebuild some of the greens fill pads a lot. So when I tore down some of the Trent Jones bunkering, I had to fill on the third green and several other greens, number 7 and so forth, number 15, where I could go back and rebuild the original fill pad because a big nose might have been cut off. I mean, the greens are beautiful, and as I say, I think JB did those greens. Obviously, he was there.
Yeah,
JB was there working on the golf course a lot, and I do think he was probably the best of Ross's putting surface shapers. I don't call the top of a fill pad a green. In my belief is the green is the whole structure, all the mounds, slopes, and bunkers. That's what the green is. On top of the green sits a putting surface.
Interesting.
And I differentiate.
I've never heard it explained that way.
It's to be different.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's true. I mean, we know the all this stuff started with Golf Club Atlas. A lot of these things like bunker complex, green complex, false fronts. Ross didn't create false fronts. That's all been created just by mowing, by the way we mow greens now. We mow out over the front edge and may round it off. I was listening to Golf Club Atlas recently, and they talked about a false side. So I mean, I'm making you think a little bit here.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could say, I mean, the architect built the slope, but you're saying that it was intended to hold a ball because back in 1929, because of
Ross,
the length of the grass.
the only place that I felt that I believe Ross would sort of fold a little bit of the putting surface over the front edge was on an uphill hole.
Right, so you can see a little
And
bit
he
of it.
loved nothing more than making a player play uphill to a pin that you couldn't see the bottom of. I mean, he would use that. That's probably the most significant characteristic of his best architecture. I mean, if you go downhill, sooner or later you got to come back uphill. But he really, I think he felt like that lengthened and strengthened his golf courses. If you look at his routings, which are brilliant, I mean, he repeatedly uses that, and he goes downhill on a par three.
Right. High point to high point.
Or short four. I mean, here's a guy that was not that well educated, but he was incredible. He comes from a 14-year-old carpentry apprentice in Dornoch, and then he ends up driving a big car, dressed nice,
It's the American dream,
Mingling
baby.
with all sorts of wealth. He got a lot further than I did.
A little bit more.
Look,
So
my
that
house is right outside this window down there.
yeah, you're I've seen you
I
show
would
you
say my
send me a picture of your
house
house.
is
You're
outside
doing
this
okay.
window
You're doing
down there.
okay.
I'm at my neighbor's. The daughter here is more technically capable of putting me on Zoom
Well,
today.
we thank her. We tip our hat to her.
So,
She made this happen. Well, let's get let so you mentioned the green restructuring. So you did reconstruct some of the green pads at Aronimink. Did you feel that that was
yes.
correcting work that RTJ did, or was that just due to years and years of maintenance and build up and wear and tear?
No, I knew that Trent Jones peeled away those fill portions of the fill pad because I was there while he was doing it. I spent a couple of days. I don't live that far away from Aronimink, so
Yeah.
I would go out there and watch it and take more slides. And I didn't say anything to anybody, not
Sneaking
even the
around
general manager. I
behind
just
trees, snapping
minded my
photographs.
own business with my camera.
Espionage work.
The interesting thing is, Derek, that whenever I've reconstructed a green on a golf course, I've rebuilt it the exact way I find it. And usually the old greens on these old golf courses, whether it's Charles River or Portland Country Club or Idlehour in Lexington, they're all, if you excavate down in them, like Mountain Ridge, we had to do a lot of work on three greens. If you go down deep enough, you're going to find about 5 inches of accumulated top dressing, and they're going to find sort of maybe 8 inches of sort of a sticky black soil,
Yeah, the
which
muck.
was originally topsoil, and then you go right into clay. And some have drainage in the later part of his career. But so when I have expanded greens or rebuilt greens, I just replicate what the body of the green is exactly like. I don't bring in USGA stuff. I put in a mixture that's soil based, maybe 60% sand, 40% soil, or 70-30 or something. And I rebuild those portions of the greens. If I rebuild a new green on a golf course, I build it with the same structural integrity that all the other 17 greens have. And it's worked all over. Cedar Rapids, we built one new green, and because I wanted to have two greens on one hole, I built a new green closer to the next tee and just did it the same as the other original 18. And they were just old, crude greens, You go to Charles River in Boston, I mean, these are the greens that are 100 years old, and they never change them, and they're still doing fine. They may not be perfect every day of the golf season. They vary, but that's part of golf anyway.
So when you think of running screens,
I mean, you know, you put the green there, it's a quarter. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
When you think of
I'm on a roll.
Yeah, I'm gonna keep prompting you. You started working there in 1994. My understanding is you did another big, significant work in 2003, and that kind of set the golf course up throughout the 2000s. What were your big moves in 2002 and 2003?
Well, the first couple of years we had a couple of different contractors going. I would say that we restored probably 10 holes in the last in 03, 04, mm-hmm. or 02, 03, whichever. You know, we got to the point where we just got on with it. You know, we pecked away at it for a few years, and you know, I don't know where the responsibility lied, you know.
But during that time, you did. I'm trying to get to the greens at Aronimink, and then we're going to have talk about how, you know, their character of the greens. But you did reconstruct some of the greens between 1994 and 2004.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At Aronimink. Yes.
Yeah.
We expanded the fill pass. We didn't completely rebuild any greens. Just
expansion.
Just the back right corner, maybe 35 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But mostly just adding a big nose. I've expanded all the putting surfaces at Aronimink all the way around where they had just been mowing for different years, tighter and tighter, smaller circles, so to speak. So we pushed all those greens out to the optimum portion of the fill pass surface. We pushed all those collars out. Now, I like to lay the collars over the edge anyway. I want the ball to be released.
To me, that's probably the most interesting thing about Aronimink screens is the way the exterior edges and shoulders intersect into the putting surface. They're tied into their shoulders, and you have these brows and these kind of waves along the outside and back edges that influence hole locations around the perimeter of the green. I don't think that's unique to Ross. I think he always, not always, but often tried to build shoulders that influence the putting surface. But at Aronimink, it's very much part of the playing character.
Right. And Pinehurst has had a big influence in that and keeping it that way and influencing it with other golf courses. But at Aronimink, the 10th green may be my favorite green in golf.
So cool.
You know, I shouldn't say it because I have lots of favorites. But there's a big, big swale in the middle of the green. Yeah. It's just unbelievable. I mean, it's not like a Brit thing, you know. It's just...
Well, it kind of goes from front to back, too. It's like a big butt
cheeks. Yeah, slight angle. But it's, I mean, just to have the courage to do that, that was just, and I'm giving JB the credit, just amazing. And there are several other greens on Aronimink that have a lot of character and some that have just very subtle, which I hate the word subtle because, I mean, I meet a lot of meetings.
It sounds pejorative.
And I say the greens don't have a lot of character. And they say, yeah, but they're really subtle.
Well, there's a difference between no character and subtle. Subtle can have character.
I think greens need to be subtle. You look at the PGA Tour every weekend now. There's nothing but subtle greens. 50-foot putts have a 1-foot break. I mean, listen, there's not a great golf. I'm going to say one thing. There's not a great golf course in the world that doesn't have great putting surfaces.
Agreed. Yes.
But we're destroying it in America.
Green speeds.
Because we're going to a tenth of an inch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, at Aronimink, it's going to be interesting to
see. Take all those stimp meters and...
Yeah, throw them in the lake. At Aronimink, it'll be interesting to see where they put the hole locations. I mean, if they want to PGA Tour it up, they can find some flat spots and let players, you know, shoot below the hole and then have 10-foot uphill birdie putts that break 2 inches, 3 inches. Or they can kind of put them around the perimeters or in the troughs or right on a brow that goes into one of those troughs and get some really interesting cross-screen putts and put a real premium on approach shots. But it depends on how they set it up. Because Aronimink does have those troughs through the greens. You mentioned 10, which is a great one. The par 4 fourth has a little trough in. There's a bowl at the front left of 5. Seven, 14 have little troughs. And then you have these other holes that have these ridges and brows in them that kind of create two separate sections of the green. So let me just ask you this. Where do you think Aronimink's greens rank among some of the other sets of greens that Ross designed?
Really good. Really good. Really high.
Really high.
Really high on my own. And I think Mountain Ridge is also the same. Mountain Ridge has one flat green. It's number 13, or number 3. But all the greens at Mountain Ridge are really good, you know. And that's, unfortunately, that wasn't normal because Ross was doing so much work, you know, that, but I do give McGovern credit for that. Do you know Ross never put a par on any golf course, on any scorecard he ever put on any golf course? Look at the routing plan right in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah, he's just got hole yardages. There's no par.
Yeah.
That's it.
I'll let people figure that one out, but that's I've won money on that.
Yeah. No, you just gave away your you won't get any more money off of that bet anymore. You just tipped your hand. All right.
Well, I would tell people that and they would bet me. I'll bet you downstairs our routing player has a par on every hole.
Nice. I'm gonna look into that. Here's one of Holston Hills. Nothing, no par. Yeah, interesting. The other topic before we get into the specific holes that we like is trees. There's a lot of conversation right now over the last 25 years about tree removal, and I'm starting to think, and others have said it as well, that perhaps we're getting a little too heavy-handed with tree removal. When you encountered Aronimink, it was probably undoubtedly over-treed or overgrown. Would you say, is that how you would describe it? Just through decades of tree planting and maybe not having a great plan for how those trees were going to mature?
Well, if you look at my restoration plan, there's a lot of trees that are crossed out, hatched, and they were supposed to be removed. And there were a lot of really majestic red oaks on that property. And I'm not gonna bring up why they're dead, but they're all gone.
Right.
I think it's gone overboard. Mm-hmm. I really do. I think it's really gone overboard. I was right in the very beginning arguing with the USGA about tree removal on some golf courses. Once it caught fire, it's just a raging blaze. And you know, for the sake of a vista, this is all you hear. I know you get a little bit of air circulation and all reasons to justify taking down trees, but there's no question that it's gone too far. I'm sad because Aronimink, you know, lost not simply took down a lot of his trees, but lost them.
Yeah, it's kind of goes back to the idea of originalism. Because just the obvious example that we always go back to is Oakmont. Yeah. And when you look at early Oakmont photographs, there are very few trees. So you could justify it and say, well, when the golf course opened, it was in basically pasture land, agricultural land. There were no trees. So it's okay to remove all these trees that were planted by human beings in the subsequent years. Aronimink, I'm not sure
Check your photographs. Well, check the photographs at Aronimink. But gill use, very few trees. 1929.
Yes, that's when
So
it
here we
opened,
are,
right?
100 years later,
Yeah.
and we're back. We've taken down, I think, more trees than we needed to. I mean, I don't mind taking down trees where you've got an understory, like a pine tree or something, where guys have got to get on their hands and knees to scoop a ball out from under the tree. But I don't mind having big old hardwoods where you've got to work the ball right or left or around it, or chip it out in the fairway if you're right behind the tree. There's nothing wrong with that. You could play a shot and you're penalized because you hit it over there behind that oak tree, or but I mean, Aronimink, if you look at the original photography on that has all those bunker clusters, I've got one sitting down in my office just down the hill here. No trees,
Yeah.
very few trees. Very few trees around the clubhouse. Now they have big, massive oak trees.
Yeah. I guess what I'm saying is that would lend
Well,
cover to the idea of removing massive amounts of trees at Aronimink that had been planted after the course opened. And I mean, I think I'm
yeah,
sympathetically I'm toward
right.
I'm I think there's a balance. I think there's always, just because a tree didn't exist when the golf course opened doesn't mean it doesn't have value. But we certainly can think of case after case after case of where too many trees were planted, or planted in the wrong places, or the wrong species of trees.
Wrong species.
And there's it's a case by case
The tree.
basis of what you maintain, but and what you remove. But taking out all the trees probably doesn't make sense at most places. I think that's going too far.
We're adding a lot. We're probably dumping a lot of fuel on a lot of fires right now because we're not the only ones that feel the way you do and I do. We're not the only ones that we're fighting p committees that got carried away. I mean, I work with some superintendents that I started the ball rolling on removing a sensible number of trees, particularly pine trees and so forth. And then there was pressure immediately to take down some more, and the superintendents would have a reason. Well, there's too much shade on the green or something, I would just beg them not to do it. I wouldn't approve it. I feel a little responsible almost because I used to argue with you.
Yeah, Ron, I was just going to say that being the forerunner of restoration, I mean, I think you were also on the forefront of tree removal, proposing and but context matters. And tree removal in the context of the 1980s and 1990s is much different than in the 2000 and 2010s and 2020s. Courses were so overgrown. You can look at any golf course picture book of courses from the 70s and 80s, and it's remarkable how crowded the fairways were and how branches were overhanging. I mean, it just got out of control. So obviously there's room to improve
You
there.
want me to tell you? You got a minute for a funny story?
Yeah, this is a podcast. We have all the time in the world.
I did the restoration of New Haven Country Club.
Yeah.
It's an old Willie Park Jr. course up in Connecticut. And when I got there, they had a row of pine trees on the outside of beautiful hardwoods. So if you're going down one hole, it's a big row of pine trees, and then hardwoods, and then pine trees here, where the other hole is. So I crossed out all these trees to go. Mostly they were evergreens, blocking the view of hardwoods, basically. I marked down probably 700 trees on this golf course. Then I went away. The plan was adopted, and I'm away. I'm not going to tell the guy's name who was the green chairman, but he won the New England Amateur at one time. He's a good golfer and young guy. He called me about, I'm just going to say, 5 weeks later. He said, "Ron, I'd like you to come back up and take a look at the golf course. We've done some tree removal." I drove back up to New Haven, and they had taken down all 700 trees, and they're all laying across the fairway. I was in shock. But it turned out to be beautiful, but I don't know how that guy was still alive 5 weeks after we got that.
Yeah, we need a better plan. Let's execute. It's all in the execution.
Oh boy, that was one. I mean, that was really wonderful.
Let's talk about some of the individual holes at Aronimink. We've talked about 10 and
Great.
that amazing green that has that little valley through the middle. And if you're on the left or right side of that putting surface and you have to putt across that, you're going to have some adventure. And I love that feature. A lot of people may not realize is that pond front left. And this is the 10th hole at Aronimink is a really strong hole. It's one of the hardest on the golf course. You tee off high, the fairway runs out, it's pretty narrow at this point, and then it kind of drops down to a lower level, but I don't know how many people have the distance to get down to the lower level. So you're kind of hitting off this plateau across this into this green, and there's a pond short left with a steep bank. That pond was added in the 1980s.
No, that pond was added by a guy named Ron Pritchard.
Are you sure you added that pond?
I'm pretty sure.
Well, I think you would remember.
I'm pretty sure I did. Yeah, I kind of re I
I
can't
thought that was
remember what we
there.
did with the dirt with.
Oh, all right. Well, let's if
I
you don't
don't think.
know, I thought I was looking at aerials and I could have sworn that that was added in the 80s. That's when that thing first shows up.
Yeah, I'm a little unsure, but I do. If it was, I know at least I pushed it into the green up to,
Okay.
if I didn't build a whole pond, I pushed way closer to the green.
Yeah.
It was pretty
It
far
was
removed,
it's
so I
not
got it.
original. That was added by some joker at some point in history. Not too far past.
Another joker that got involved and moved it closer to the
So keep that in mind. That
green.
Ross didn't put that there. Just
No, he didn't.
overall, as and we've touched on this, what do you think the golf course's strengths are? What makes Aronimink, one of the arguably one of the 100 best courses in the United States? Is it the routing? What do you think of Ross's routing on that piece of land?
I think the routing is terrific. I mean, it's really an interesting routing. I have to think about, but you can. It's easy to follow tour events there. You go three or four different spots, and holes come back to you. They go out and come on back to you, and then you got another loop of holes. And so I do think the routing is really good. Ross built beautifully balanced golf courses. With par threes, three and a halves, fours, four and a halves, and fives. Four and a half, you make a four today and a five tomorrow. You see what I'm saying? He built beautifully, he routed beautifully balanced golf courses, number one. And I think he was, I've never seen a golf course where I personally could improve his routing. I think he was so good at it. But I do think at Aronimink, and at any great golf courses, it's primarily the putting surfaces that really. That really, I mean, Ross envisioned golf as two games in one. One was the first was a journey from tee to green, and then the great game began. You see what I'm saying? So I do. I mean, I listened to Keegan Bradley talk us through the hole on the Smiley Show 2 days ago, I think it was. He talked about on the first 7 holes, and so he thinks he's going to be hitting a wedge almost everything that's not a par three. And he might hit a wedge on five, which, I mean, he was in a sense saying, particularly the front side is going to be pretty easy. I mean, he thinks of birdie hole after birdie hole, although he understands that getting on the putting surface is going to be the challenge,
Right. Yeah.
narrowing. I think they're narrowing the fairways down to 90 feet, which I don't like, because then you've got to have your bunker surrounded by rough.
Sure. Exactly.
You can't get into it like at Oakmont. You couldn't get into a bunker unless you hit it in on the fly, because it was all surrounded by rough. So when we started firing fairways, Ross, if you look at Ross's drawings, I mean, he had fairways 170, 180 feet wide on some of his drawings. We don't do that, but his bunkers were all in the fairway. And even when you narrow them down to 105 feet or 110 feet, still two-thirds of the bunker is in the fairway, so you can run balls in.
That's the
Of the
accommodation we
200
make
feet you got
toward,
around them, you can walk.
it's the accommodation we make to par, thinking about professional and the impact of the professional game. We care, tournaments and other people care so much about what the final score is. You have to do things like shrink the fairways to 30 yards across to bring the rough in, because that's the really one of the only effective ways to
Right.
minimize low scoring, other than just getting your greens rock hard, firmness and
Remember,
rough.
Ross didn't put a par on his golf course.
It'd be interesting.
So,
But
but you're right. I mean,
and that helps ratings and reputation too, like that. I get it. People want to, the viewing public wants to see a certain amount of struggle and carnage when they watch the best players in the world. So you got to pull the rough in.
I had that conversation with Dean Beaman when I did the Tournament Players Club in Memphis, and Dean was a good guy. I mean, he really treated nicely and gave me a nice opportunity to do that golf course, which was built by my twin brother, by the way. We used to go frog gigging on a pond there. I'll tell you, but anyway, I was talking to Dean, and I said, Dean, I want this golf course to be pretty tough, and I, you know, he said, no, he said, Ron, we want red numbers on the scoreboard. That's what he, that's what he said the tour wants. And I said, I don't believe in that. I said, I don't believe that. I said, I think people want to see heroics and disaster.
That's a good
So,
way to
but
put it.
we had a friendly disagreement, and that's good. I mean, that's good. You remember those conversations.
For sure. I think the land, I think Aronimink, the land is good, but not, it's not a spectacular property. It has just enough character to that the routing can take advantage of some of those long slopes, a few abrupt places. It's got some level upland holes, and then it slopes down, and then it goes back up, and some watery areas low. So it's got just enough to make a compelling routing, but it's not a great piece of land.
And you're right, exactly where they place the pins is going to be the crucial decision, hole after hole.
What do you think is the, if you had to think of one hole that's not your favorite, we'll get to your favorite hole or favorite holes, but what do you think is the strongest hole?
Oh, in a way, I like number seven. It's a very unique hole. I saved that little house. They were going to knock that house down on the left side because they had a lot of damage to some of the rafters and stuff, and they were going to take it down. I begged them not to. So that I mean that's it's a beautiful. It's really a cool hole because I don't know what the players are going to hit on that hole. They may try, since a fair amount of trees are gone, they may almost go straight for the green with a driver. I don't know.
So this hole,
I don't know because the big bunker.
this hole for the listeners, and I encourage you, if you haven't done this yet, Google or go to Golf Digest and watch my Every Hole at Aronimink video, and you can get a picture of the seventh hole. But for the record, Ron, I would have said seven too. That's my selection for this category of strongest hole. It's a dog leg right. The tee shot is blind off the tee. It starts off on the upper plateau, and then it drops down, bends right, and the fairways are reverse camber that kicks everything to the left. And then on the inside corner, there are these cool shaggy moguls. They're just these little dolomite kind
And
of
they were
mounds.
added. You know, a lot of those.
And then it plays back uphill to this green that's kind of anchored onto the side of the hill with a ton of slope on it. And it's just a really great way to use the natural contour of the land to create a really difficult driving hole. And then, and yeah, if players just want to hit driver, knock it down the hill and say, even if I'm in the rough, I'm okay. I can wedge, you know, I can hit a 70 yard shot back up to the green, but still coming out of the rough, controlling the spin, that could be a very interesting hole to watch. And it's just a really, it's probably my favorite hole out there.
Yeah, smart play maybe to hit an iron to the turn, 3-iron, 4-iron to the turn, and then hit a full shot to the green.
That's right. Yes, and it's only 419 from the back tees. You know, so it's not a long hole.
Yeah.
It's a long hole for me, but for the PGA players, it's not. And by the way, that hole is called Shawnee. All the holes at Aronim Inc. have Native American tribe names for them. Which is kind of cool.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if they've always done that, but they have that now. What's your favorite hole? I mean, if you had to go play it, like, what hole gets you excited to play?
I mean, I like one a lot, to be honest. I think the tee's way up. And the fairway just keeps climbing and climbing and climbing. And we built a whole lot of the back left of that green of the big old maple tree right on the fill pad.
Really?
I mean, I'm going to, you know, probably was 70 years old. We took that down and had to rebuild 40 feet of the green back there.
Wow.
That's
a big part of the character of that hole is that back left hole location.
Yeah, that whole angle, that angle that the green is laid in there at. I like that. Let me think. You know, I can remember funny stories about other holes, like the president of the club on 14. There's a short bunker. It's a par 3.
Yeah.
I don't know how long the hole is. 170 maybe. And there's a bunker that's 30 yards short of the green. The opening day, I mean, he was belly aching about, why did you ever put that bunker there? And the opening day, I happened to be going by hole when he teed off, and he dumped it right in that bunker.
Cold topped it right into that bunker that shouldn't even come into play.
That's why that bunker's there.
That's great.
You know, I mean, there's so many ways to enjoy golf, isn't there? Having fun and needling people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The first hole is. Yeah, let's take a minute to talk about the first hole. It's called Apache. It plays over a little creek. The fairway tilts up, and then you have to hit another kind of blind second shot uphill to that green where you can probably only see, you know, the flag stick. You really can't see much of the surface depending on how strong your drive was. You know, Ross was known for, you know, he's on record as saying, you know, the first hole should give you a chance to kind of get into your game, although I know he built a lot of really challenging first holes. Aronimink's first hole is pretty challenging right out of the gate. And that green is the only one at Aronimink that has like distinct levels. It's got the upper plateau and the lower plateau, and you can put pins on both levels. So it's unique in that regard. What I'm going to go with at Aronimink, my favorite hole, and this may upset you, Ron, a little bit. I love the third hole. And I think that the J.B. McGovern bunker scheme there, as Gil adjusted the distances, is absolutely fascinating. The way it creates those different pocket staggered landing zones on the left-hand side. And you want to come into that green from the left. So if you're really on your game, you can kind of figure out what club to try to land it in those different zones. Or you can play safe to the right and leave yourself an iron shot coming kind of across the green over that bunker to a green that's not as receptive from that angle. And it's just a really
Yeah, pretty level ground. We had to add a lot of the right rear on that fill pad. A big piece of that green was peeled away by Trent. And but you know, I mean, I mentioned before, I've never seen Ross duplicate a hole on any golf course. I've always... You know, there is a par 3 that he builds with sand all the way around several times.
Number 5 at Aronimink.
Pittsburgh, Massachusetts is an Oak Hill also that he did. And, mm-hmm. But I really, that's why I admire him so much. He sketched, when he walked the field, he sketched all the bunker shapes carefully in the field. Somehow, must have had a board that had, he put paper on, a little piece of paper. I've often said, if that was me, would have put a circle there and gone back to my office and drawn the bunker, but not. So I really, that's something I appreciate when you know how he worked. And
I guess when you're as busy as he was and traveling as much, you have to be efficient and make those notes in the field. You don't know when you're going to have a chance to look at that again.
yeah, I guess he wanted to give the client their money's worth, and it wasn't a lot of money in those days.
All right, one more. If, to be generous, if Iran Mink has a weak hole, what do you think its weakness would be?
Maybe 13 straight away, because they're thinking they might move up the tees once they might, they might make that drivable.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
Who is also kind of short, par four, little tiny dog leg left. I mean, where there are trees, there's a big inner patch of trees on Aronimink, but when we're talking about the tree removal, most of it's on the individual holes. But yeah, and I think, again, it's always the greens. I think number nine, is pretty strong. But it'll be interesting to see how many people get there in two, because holding the green and getting up on the green is going to be a little bit of an achievement, it's not outrageously elevated, but it's all carry from wherever they hit their second shot, yeah, 10's a good hole.
Ten's a unique hole too. It has its own
Yes.
character.
Yeah, very unusual topography, because the right side is elevated and real strong, and that's an interesting hole.
Another hole just while we're talking about it to kind of jump around, but one of the greens that I find the most interesting is the eighth green. That's the long downhill par three hole,
Right.
and it sits at a it's
Right.
it's it's long, it's elongated more than most greens, and it's tilted at an angle, which isn't really that common at Aronimink. Most of the greens
That's
are kind of
right.
squarish and sit square to the line of play. This one is, and the shoulders on that green on the left especially push everything away, and then it falls off in the back. When I saw that, and I would love to hear your thoughts on that, when I saw that for the first time, I thought this green has been rebuilt. This looks like a modern green that doesn't fit in with the rest of the greens on this golf course. So somebody must have, maybe Gil Hance and Jim, completely rebuilt this. But what, I mean, your thoughts on that green? I don't think that's the case, but that's what I thought.
I think it's cool. I mean, I added all that chipping area all the way from 10 to 8 when
Okay.
we did that. That was not our plan. I
That's
think
really
that's
neat that the way
cool.
that it joins those two greens together. They sit by side by side, and
Yeah.
they're like twins in a way.
So I mean, that's good. If you hit it over the green, or if you pull it on 8 or hit it over the green on 10, that's really not nice, So we took advantage of a big old hollow that was there anyway, But, yeah, eight's tough. I mean, a lot of guys fade the ball, but I still think that's going to be a tougher shot into that green, than normal. It's a big old long, reverse redan, just simply the layout of the hole. I'm not saying it's a redan, but the redan has absolutely the opposite angle,
In the three PGA Tour tournaments they've played at Aronimink in the last 15 years, I think the eighth was the most difficult hole in relation to par. So
Wasn't
so something to look forward to this week at the PGA. And I expect that to probably again be one of the hardest holes on the course.
concerned about short irons, half wedges and three quarter wedges being played too often. I think the backside is going to be a little bit stronger, but I think it's going to be vulnerable from that standpoint. Yeah, I mean, if Tiger were playing the golf course, he might not be taking the driver out of his bag very often, for example,
Yeah. The fairway bunkering at Aronim Inc. is so strong for guys like me, for people who drive the ball, 240, 250, some, just normal players. It's in the worst places. And I by worst I mean it's exactly where you don't want it to be because it's going to catch your drives. So you really have to think about your drives. If you're a PGA Tour player who can carry it 310, it's just irrelevant. Like I think of the bunkers on four. Ross set those fairway bunkers up beautifully, so you either have to kind of cut one in there between the short bunker right
At
and
the
that
crown of the hill.
cross bunker. It's at the crown of the hill. I mean, it's just infuriating if you're somebody, a member playing it. The pros are just going to take it right over that cross bunker and just have a, to your point. A 90-yard shot into that green. So they're just going to take a lot of the great bunkering out of play.
But there, what people need to understand about Ross is that he didn't bunker his golf courses mathematically. He wasn't necessarily concentrating on penalizing or challenging any particular class of player. All he did was go out on the ground and read the ground. And wherever the ground gave him an opportunity to build a bunker, even if it was 90 yards in front of the tee, that's where he built the bunker. So he just read the ground, and where there were rolls and opportunities to put a bunker, he put it there. I mean, it's so simple, his thinking, and it's so correct. I mean, now we work so hard to put it at 290 on the left side where he hits a hook, or
Yeah.
270 on the right side where it catches a fade. We kill ourselves in this country with our little engineer scale, trying to get it exactly where it's going to affect. Ross did not, he didn't rely upon fairway bunkering. He just put them where the ground gave. He was, they didn't move much dirt. All they did was build tees, bunkers, and greens. They didn't change the fairways very much. So golf courses could be built fairly fast in those days, even though people don't know that. Charles River was a terrible piece of ground. A lot of stone, a lot of trees, and they built that golf course, I mean, I'm going to say in a year and a half.
That would sort of,
Amazing.
I'd have to think about this more. You could his the way Ross constructed courses, as you're describing, the quality of the course or the reaction that we have to them and how much we like them often then would depend on the character of the land. The more smaller movements the land has that gave him an opportunity to position bunkers and position, greens in unique locations, probably come across as more vivid than a course like Aronim Inc., where it's bigger, flatter plains, where there aren't as many abrupt pieces, pockets of land where to anchor a bunker. So the visuals are a little different. And maybe, I don't know, maybe that's something that McGovern was picking up on and saying, we need to create a little more visual interest on this golf course by kind of jazzing it up with more bunkers.
Could have been. I mean, a lot of architects today have a different idea, a different approach to bunkering, and than Ross ever did.
Yeah.
So.
Let me run this one by you. If you asked me what I think the weaknesses are or the weakest holes, I'm going to go with 17. That hole, when you get to that corner of the property after playing the previous 16 holes, it feels like you're just all of a sudden you've moved on to a course in a different state. It doesn't like you're in Indiana or something. It just doesn't. It's such a visual and emotional departure from the rest of the golf course. The green is interesting. It's wide and it has that big swale that kicks in, so you have a left and right section that really divides it, and it's a hard hole.
Front left corner is good. That Lake was pushed back against the green by Trent Jones.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
Makes
You may
sense.
have
That's something he would
better
do.
evidence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just
Yeah, but
that's
because when
the
you look on, definitely a breather, a breather, you know.
And it, you know, it's fine. It gets you to the 18th tee, and now it sets you up for a really tough closing hole, which every golf club is proud to have a really tough 18th hole. This one climbs uphill, parallel to
Yep.
nine. It's kind of like a classic old golf course finishing hole. You know, uphill, tough. You know, make or break in a match. But the 17th, yeah,
Yep.
It's just a weird hole to me. The other hole I want to talk to you about is 11, because I don't know what to make of the 11th hole. It has the more bunkers on it now than any other hole in the golf course. It's just littered with bunkers left, right off the tee and all around the green. It's kind of a slightly uphill fairway, not a lot of character to the movement of the land. Then you get up to the green, it's benched into this hill, and the slope on the green is just ridiculous. I mean, I think there are like two pinnable places on that whole green. And if you're above the hole, goodbye, daddy. You know, it might even roll off the front. I thought about saying that was the weakest hole in the course. I think you'd find up people that would say that that's the best hole on the course, just for the same reasons. It's probably the most polarizing hole, perhaps. Thoughts on 11? You worked on it. You know the hole pretty well. What do you think?
Pretty much agree with you. We did a lot of work on that to get that little creek coming down the hill and putting it in a pipe and taking it under the fairway, there was originally a pipe going under that fairway. But you're right about the bunkering. I'm not happy about the back bunkering on the green. They were never, you know, Ross did not put bunkers in that position. There's three bunkers in the back. I
Right.
mean, that should have just been a big old hollow. And when I was there, it was kind of a gentle hollow behind the green. Catch shots that ran over the green, putting surface. I didn't realize it was that steep, the slope of the putting surface itself. You know the difference between a tenth of an inch and an eighth of an inch. I'm going to tell you, it's 25 thousandths of an inch, right? Piece of copy paper is 4 mil, 4 thousandths of an inch. You take six pieces of copy paper and put them on top of each other. That's the difference between a tenth and an eighth. And when we start mowing at a tenth, I think we've gone over the tipping point. I talked to several superintendents at Augusta, at Pinehurst, and they mow at they the height of cuts an eighth of an inch. I mean, I think that's something to really think about. I think the stimp meter and what we're doing, people wanting fast greens, could result in some of the best greens in the United States being rebuilt by the younger generation of architects who don't necessarily think the way I do. And so, I mean, there was at Huntington Valley, which is, you know, in northern Philadelphia. There were three nines, and one of the nine holes was abandoned during World War II, and I restored it years later, and there were slopes of 6 and 7% slopes on those greens, and I didn't change the greens, so I don't know what, you know, my belief was put them back the way they were. And I don't know what it's like today, if they've ever done anything with that. But, you know, in Ross's day, that was puttable. Now, under 3% will keep a ball rolling forever.
Yes. Yeah.
At the same speed. I found this on a golf course in Tennessee where I tested in the field and found a place where I could put a ball down, touch it hard, and just tap it so it would roll over once, and it keeps going. 50 feet, same speed, 2.9%. And he was more than an eighth of an inch.
the younger generation of architects you mentioned will have to kind of put on their big boy pants. I mean, if they're gonna like preserve the character of old greens, people are gonna have to figure out ways to tell green committees and mostly green committees, no, you know, we're not gonna mess with this green. You guys are gonna have to figure out how to maintain the length of the grass here. Yep. So that we can preserve these contours. Because if you want a tenth of an inch or whatever the height is so that they roll 13 or 14, you're gonna lose these greens. And I really hope that the people that are inheriting the responsibility of these great old clubs and new clubs too, new courses as well that have really great greens are strong enough to walk away and say, no, we're not doing it. I don't have much faith that that's going to happen. Clubs will always find somebody to do it because the desire to have fast greens is just too much of a temptation. It's too much of a medal around your neck.
And the people that are pushing for that are not necessarily the most educated, you know, about the history of the game or the traditions of their golf course. I know that Gil was very careful about the work he did at Oakland Hills, north of Detroit.
Yeah, no, it's right? It's with outstanding.
The clubhouse.
Yeah, exactly. Oakland Hills, the South Course. Yeah, fantastic. It turned out great.
Yeah, I know that there are ways today. There are ways today that even 10 years ago you couldn't very easily catalog exactly what all the slopes were. And now they have the capability to, I mean, it takes time. I did a green at Mountain Ridge, which I'm not really happy with. And it was basically, the contractor was a pusher, you know, and a great guy, but he couldn't make any money by going slow. Mm. And I wanted the club to hire an engineer because I wasn't capable in that particular period of time to replicate what Ross originally designed, but just lay it down a little bit, you know, so just drop the back and, you know, like, I mean, like I had a green at Cedar Rapids Country Club that was 7 feet drop from back to front in 90 feet.
Wow. You
know, so that's pretty damn steep. Mm-hmm. And we had to lay the back down. We had a big old hollow behind the green so we could lay the back of the green down and replicate all the bumps and hollows and ridges and so forth. But, you know, that takes time. Vincent van Gogh painted some of his paintings in a couple hours. You know, he would paint 6 or 7 paintings a day. But you can't be Vincent van Gogh on golf architecture.
Painting and golf course construction are two different skills, I think. Okay, Ron, let's wrap this up. This has been incredible. I've enjoyed this. The last thing we'll examine is, where does Ron Amink rank among Donald Ross's best courses?
Well, I think it's in his top 20, I would say, you know.
Okay.
I think it's great. I do think it's we'll see this week how they do from a standpoint of how much muscle it has.
Sure. That's a different metric.
It's right.
From the courses that you've seen and you've worked on and that touch your heart, this would be closer to top 20 than top 10.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's top 10 easily when it comes to the putting surfaces, but I think the overall muscle of the golf course distance-wise is what, you know, is they're limited. And now they're stretching golf courses to 75, 7600 and more and longer, you know. Can't go any longer at Ron Amink, so it's always going to have that kind of a cap, you know.
To me, I value courses like I'll watch the PGA Championship. I'm interested to see how the course does. I hope it's competitive. I hope you know, there's some drama involved. That's why I watch tournament golf. But golf courses to me are I literally could care less about how the professionals play them or how long they are. It's just, how does it affect me? How much do I want to play there? Like, how anxious am I to take another chance to hit that drive or to hit that approach shot, or how interesting are the short game recoveries? You know, is my brain turned on? Are the wheels spinning? Are my eyes bright? And Aronimink has a lot of great things about it. I won't say that it titillates me the way I like to be tickled when I play golf. It doesn't have the charm factor that is important to me. I think it's a really strong golf course. It has a lot of admirable qualities. One of the, you know, probably, I don't know. I don't know Ross as well as you do. I haven't seen enough of Ross to really come up with a top whatever that makes, that means anything. But I would just say that there are other courses that I know of Ross that I think are, we mentioned Oakland Hills. I think that one, that's a course that really, if you told me we were playing Oakland Hills tomorrow, I would be excited. I would have a hard time going to sleep tonight. That's kind of how I view it in that context.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. I mean, I think the rollback will help.
If it's enough.
I wrote a letter to David Fay in 1993, five pages. Yeah, if it's enough. They say they think they'll limit it to a,
you sent that letter to me, I read it.
30-yard yeah. carry.
Mm-hmm. It was great. It was a great letter.
Well, anyway.
They didn't listen to you.
I've been upset for a long time. And more important people in the world of golf than me, Jack Nicklaus was always bothered. He's been bothered by it. This longer than I have, or at least as long as I have. He's a year younger than me to the very day, by the way.
Really?
We share the same birthday.
I think you might be able to take him on the golf course these days.
That's not an important. If I take him on the same match.
had to wait a few.
Or running.
Yeah, you had to wait about seven decades before you could say that, but.
That's right, but the especially the wrestling match.
Yeah.
But the with the rollback, I mean, they don't think it's going to affect the average player a lot, and I think that's, I guess that makes sense, you know.
I was going to say, there's this subheader of this podcast. We're talking about Aronimink, but the subheader would be, the ball goes too far and the greens roll too fast. That's where we are in golf course architecture and design now. All right, Ron, let's wrap this up. Do you have any final thoughts on Aronimink? Okay. You excited, at least excited to see the professionals tackle the course?
I am. It was fun seeing the walkthrough with Keegan on the Smiley show. I had a lot of positive thoughts, negative reactions about some of the things I saw and heard. But I'm excited. I hope the course holds up well and makes the members proud. I mean, that was always my, you know, the most important thing to me when I worked on these golf courses was that the members were proud of it when they got done.
Right.
Usually they were, because, you know, it's gone all around the world, restoration of golf courses. It's doing it in Australia and Japan. So it's had a good influence on the game, I think.
And memberships ultimately have the right to play the golf course they want to play. And that's why, I hate to say it, but all of the generation, your generation, and all the work that you did restoring courses back to the historical accuracy of their origins, right, as much as possible, that's probably going to change. You know, we've seen it at Aronimink. They made a change to do a different version of the course, which is also historically accurate. But other courses that have been put back, I'm using air quotes, you know, put back to the way it was original, will slowly, in the coming years slide into renovations and remodels and even modernizations, and then somebody will come back, you know, in 25, 40 years and have to reset it all again. That's the nature of the game. But the point is, that's the right of every membership, is to have the golf course that they want. If you get enough people on board, you can do it's your golf course. You get to do with it what you want. We may not like it as purists,
it's
but
happening today. No, it happens today. I mean, really, new younger men come in and take the leadership of the club as president, vice president, members of the board of governors, you know, and the green committee, that have a different idea about the game than 30 years ago. Just like the guys 30 years ago had a different idea than the guys 30 years prior, you know. So it's happening right now, and I'm not happy about it in some respects. But I do think, you know, there are clubs on Long Island that are not Shinnecock, for example, which is really one of my favorite courses. I mean, I think that's way up in my ratings. Probably number two in my ratings. I really like it. But there's a lot of good courses, country clubs, golf clubs on Long Island that they're not going to have any major events. And they've got exciting, well-designed, well-restored golf courses to play forever.
You said Shinnecock's number two. Just out of curiosity, what's number one?
I like Pine Valley.
Yeah, me too.
I like Pine Valley because I can, when you go there and you see the amount of effort it took to build that golf course, it's pretty astonishing.
Well, Ron, thanks for doing this. It was amazing to get your thoughts on Aronimink and many other topics. This is a joy to talk to you, and let's enjoy the PGA this week. Listeners, go ahead and see the Every Hole That video that we produce at Golf Digest. It's on YouTube and at Golf Digest. You can get an up-close look at all the holes. But once again, Ron, thank you very much. This was great.
Derek, we'll keep in touch, you know.
Yes.
You have one of those names where you could turn your name around and be Duncan Derek.
I could,
you know?
Yeah. Some people people call me Duncan. I say, well, that's my one of my names. I'll go by that. I'm fine.
That's right. We'll keep in touch. I'll send you some things from time to time and to provoke, strike up your, make you think a little bit.
Keep me honest. Thanks to your neighbor. Thanks for Katie for setting this up. This was great.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And thanks to everybody that's listened to this torturous conversation.
If anybody is still listening at this point in time, you're the best. Take care, Ron. We'll talk soon.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Best to you.